Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, March 11, 2019. The black box recorder of the Ethiopian airline ET302 has been recovered.
Not too many months ago, loss of trust that we had with Boeing that had been repaired, but this incident, it's just natural for us to say, okay, let's keep our wits about us and get all the information here. So,
and a Georgetown law student from Kenya who died in the plane crash is remembered by a colleague.
And he's one of those guys that's just really humble. So it's like it's only after, you know, maybe probing on some of the comments he made, it's like, oh, well, what do you mean you have these extra scholarships? Or what do you mean you have this really great job offer, like, after law school? It's just he's just so humble.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The black box voice recorder from the Ethiopian Airlines flight number 302, which crashed shortly after takeoff on Sunday, has been recovered. All 157 passengers on board were killed. The plane had some humanitarian workers and United Nations staff. Ethiopian Airlines has suspended the commercial operations of all Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft immediately after the crash occurred. China and Indonesia have also ordered that all Boeing 737 MAX 8 planes are grounded until further notice. It is the second crash in 5 months involving a 737 MAX 8, and comparisons are being drawn to that of the Lion Air crash in Indonesia, which killed all 189 people on board October 29, 2018. Flight 302 took off in good weather, but according to data from Flight Radar 24, the aircraft seemed to experience problems with its ascent and with its vertical speed, fluctuating between about 1,400 feet of climb per minute to about 1,900 feet of descent per minute. 6 minutes later, after the takeoff, the plane crashed. The U.S. Department of State released a statement extending its deepest condolences to the families and friends of those killed in the crash and confirmed at least 8 U.S. citizens were among the victims. It said U.S. embassies in Addis Ababa and Nairobi, in coordination with the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board, are working with the government of Ethiopia and the Ethiopian Airlines to offer all possible assistance. People from more than 30 countries were on board. Canada had 18 nationals and 32 Kenyans died in the crash, according to Ethiopian Airlines. There was also 9 Ethiopians, 8 Chinese, 8 Italian, 7 British, 7 French, 6 Egyptians, 5 Dutch, 4 passengers with UN passport, 4 Indians, 3 Russians, 2 Moroccans, 2 Israeli and 1 Sudanese among those who were killed. With every commercial airline crash, pilots around the world focus their attention on what happened. The same is true for the crash of the Flight 302. A preliminary report in the investigation of the Lion Air Indonesian accident said the plane's automatic safety system repeatedly pushed the plane's nose downward despite the pilot's attempt to maintain control. Apparently, the plane's software was causing incorrect data and was attempting unnecessary safety maneuver. Pilots say Boeing had changed the safety system without informing them or training them on how to use it. Captain Dennis Stager flies with the American Airlines and is a spokesman for the Allied Pilots Association, the airline's union. He spoke with my colleague, Kate Pound Dawson.
After the Lion Air tragedy, there was a real shake in trust. Boeing had not disclosed information about a system that actually triggered during that crash and was part of the reason that the aircraft crashed. Wasn't even in our flight manual. They actually said they chose to not disclose that in the pilot flight manual. Our company was in the dark as much as we were, American Airlines, and they provided us the information as it came to us from Boeing through the FAA put out an emergency airworthiness directive So all that information was placed in our books. We were trained via ground school on that new system, and we were comfortable with knowing that system and how to intervene when it goes awry based on bad information that it was receiving in the Lion Air crash. And now today we have this incident, which it's very, very early, and we're not jumping to conclusions, but it happened in a similar flight regime as the Lion Air and had some behavior characteristics that looked similar to us, but we're not drawing any conclusions. But what our pilots are asking out on the line, and I'm a 737 captain, we're looking across the cockpit and say, okay, let's make sure we're watching this thing. And we're maintaining the margin of safety. We feel like we're prepared, but we also have to do, we're human beings, so we're dealing with the, not too many months ago, loss of trust that we had with Boeing that had been repaired. But this incident, it's just natural for us to say, okay, let's keep our wits about us and get all the information here. So it's safe to fly in that aircraft. Our men and women are doing it right now with many of our families on board. We also are very disciplined in making sure that we're the advocate for our passengers. We're a stakeholder in this, but we're also the voice of our passengers when it comes to safety. We're on that airplane with them, and we take that calling and that mission very seriously.
I think that many passengers are a little bit more surprised, I think, than pilots are at how much computerization there is in the cockpit these days. Why we would be surprised, I don't know, given how much computerization there is in everything else in our lives. But when Lion Air took place, I think people were surprised. Wait, their data could go wrong in aircraft. Surprised people and startled passengers. Did it also startle pilots when you found out?
Well, certainly if we find out that there was some technology in the aircraft that would automatically trigger and we didn't even know it existed, that was outrageous to us, unacceptable. We got that information, and now we know what to do when that technology goes awry. Technology is a great enhancement to safety, but if it's your sole dependency of safety and a margin of safety, then you have a diseased philosophy. So it's an assistant to it, but the real nuts and bolts of flying come with stick and rudder, and that's the pilots that are up there who fly the aircraft. And when technology needs to be taken out of the loop because it's run awry, the pilots are the ones that will bring that aircraft back safely. And that's something that will never change. Sometimes manufacturers want to rely on technology for lower experience level in pilots across the globe. And that's fine to have it as an enhancement. But to have it as a replacement for experience is wrong. And it will not be successful. And we're seeing pushback on that right now. So we embrace technology, but as an assistant to the safety margin, not as the foundational element of it. We are that element, and we're on the airplane, and we're going to protect our passengers with our professional pilot skills, not just our IT skills.
That was Pilot Dennis Steger with the Allied Pilots Association. He spoke with VOA's Kate Poundhouse earlier today. Nicole Foster, a second-year law student at Georgetown University, received a text message yesterday from a mutual friend and says she was shocked into silence, barely able to articulate what she was reading. Sedik Asivogwa, her friend and colleague who was a third-year student at the law school, was one of the passengers on the Nairobi-bound flight. As investigators tried to piece together what caused the crash, Foster says she wants people to remember her friend as a caring, thoughtful professional who would regularly take time to help his friends.
The thing that comes to the forefront about Cedric that I will always cherish and remember is how much of a positive spirit he was, and kind and helpful. And maybe there's one anecdote, at least for me, given my interactions with him over the past couple of months, that really, I think, just show how kind he is. We both were in East Africa this past winter, but finding tickets on my end just proved to be really elusive. They're very expensive. I couldn't get a good deal, but Cedric was able to get a really great deal at the beginning of the semester in like August or something. But he he helped me look for tickets to go to Uganda. He sat with me when he didn't have to, ran searches on his own computer, woke up on Sundays when tickets are supposedly the cheapest to help me look, just because I was, you know, so desperate to go back home in that break. So, I mean, I don't know, with law school, it's like everyone is so busy and so consumed with, you know, their own issues and school. And it's just knowing that he took time out to make sure that I could go home was something that I'll always, you know, I'll cherish. Just, you know, he invited me to go to Kenya with, you know, to see him and his fiance when I was in Uganda. So, I don't know. He was just so nice, so kind.
What was your first impression of him when you first met him?
My first impression was, wow, this guy is really smart. This guy, he's going places. So he was a year above me. So he was in his last year. I'm in my second year. And he's one of those guys that's just really humble. So it's like, it's only after, you know, maybe probing on some of the comments he made, it's like, oh, well, what do you mean you have these extra scholarships? Or what do you mean you have this really great job offer, like after law school? It's just, he's just so humble that, you know, you wouldn't know how amazing he is.
What do you remember about the last conversation you had with Cedric?
We were talking about him coming to my wedding. He was making a joke about how he better get an invitation to my wedding. And I was like, of course, Cedric, of course. What do you mean? You'll definitely be there. And it was in the campus ministries at school. And I just remember he was sitting at the table and I was on my way out. And that's when I said, okay, I'll see you later, but for sure you're getting that invitation.
You know, Cedric is such an accomplished young man. I'm wondering, what do you think he'll be most remembered for?
Probably his passion for the African people. He articulated on many occasions that he wanted to go back eventually to Kenya and work there and really make some serious changes and, you know, affecting positively, you know, the people in his community.
What do you want our listeners to know about him?
That he was kind and that he affected many lives, even on the micro sense. Because we know he is highly accomplished. That's very clear from the institutions he attended, the job offers he had, the scholarships he had. But he was a kind person that really cared about other people and cared about uplifting other people in like the daily micro sense.
That was Nicole Foster, a second-year law student at Georgetown University, speaking to Ian Dengbure from Washington, talking about her friend Cedric Asivugwa, who had been a third-year law student at Georgetown University here in Washington. The South Sudanese Civil Society Forum has suspended some of its members in what appears to be a power struggle among activists in Juba. The chairman of the South Sudan Network for Democracy and Elections accuses the former program coordinator of the South Sudan Law Society of illegally transferring a trusteeship of the forum to Justice Africa without consulting forum members. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
Sunda Chief James Okondao says when the South Sudan Civil Society Forum was formed in December 2017, three coordinators from civil society organizations were selected to represent communities and civil activists in Juba, outside the capital and in the diaspora. He says Taban Keystone, the former program coordinator of the South Sudan Law Society, was instructed to coordinate between the forum and civil society organization partners. Dow says Keystone did not follow the group's principles and objectives, so he was fired from his post in December last year.
Taban was dismissed by the Law Society, and then his PIA continued pushing at the leader of the forum. In which way? It's not legitimate to be the leader, because what did that? You represent institution, not the individual.
Dow accuses Keystone of working hand-in-hand with Rajab Mohandas, head of the Organization for Responsive Governance, both of whom he says frustrated the efforts of the Civil Society Forum. He accuses Keystone and Mohandas of submitting project proposals to donors using the names and legacy of the credible institutions in the forum without seeking their consent. And Dow accuses Keystone and Mohandas of appointing civil society representatives to the peace talks in violation of the forum's resolutions.
These individuals hijacked the forum, keeping the members ignorant of what the forum does on important issues of its structure and operation. The self-imposed leadership has transferred the trustship from South Sudan Law Society, to Justice Africa without knowledge and mandate from the civil society. These imposed individuals have gone against the very resolution passed by the forum members in December 2017 in Entebbe.
Dow says Keystone and Mohandas worked to divide civil society activists and organizations. He also accuses the two of failing to account for funds the forum receives from donors, of identifying the donors, and of describing how the funds are allocated to various projects run by forum members. Dow is asking donors to stop donating funds to Taban Keystone and Rajab Mohandas until the civil society forums appoints legitimate leaders.
We call on all the individuals representing civil society in various peace agreement, implementation mechanism and institution not to cooperate and transact business with this suspended illegal coin. We call for comprehensive financial and narrative report from this self-imposed individual to be subjected to the accountability by the forum members.
Dow says if Mohandas and Keystone fail to submit financial records and the administrative processes they directed on behalf of the forum within 10 working days, forum leaders will take immediate action against them. Keystone declined to comment to South Sudan in Focus on this story, saying he was still trying to learn more facts on the issue before responding. Mohandas agreed to an interview, but later refused to answer repeated calls or respond to text messages. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, residents of Yei Town say they are fed up with soldiers firing their weapons in the air. Find out why when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you like most about your African culture?
First of all, our celebration, it is unique. So the second one, I like the way we look for our clothes. Yeah, the way we live.
The thing I like about African culture is, first of all, the fact that it is unique. You see, African culture is unique. The second thing is that Africans like their culture, which is different from the Western people and so on.
When you see the way African lives, it is more different from the continent. So the way African lives, I like so much. The way they dress too. African, the way dresses is very nice. Have a good look.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Residents of Yei Town say rampant shooting by members of the South Sudan People's Defense Force is causing panic among the returnees who are still traumatized by effects of conflict. Last week, at least two people in Yei Town were killed by stray bullets from soldiers. Yei municipal authorities say they are enacting measures to end unnecessary shooting by soldiers. Daniel Friday-Martin reports for VOA from Yei Town.
Yei Town residents say the nighttime gunshots has interrupted the relative calm that prevailed in Yei Town for the past few months. They say the gunfire began last week after suspected soldiers killed two civilians in Lomuku residential area. Yei Town Mission Area resident Anna Abba says she has been hearing nighttime gunshots over the past week.
When I hear gunshot at night, I feel scared. And I don't sleep. Completely sleep runs out. And what I urge the government to do is like they should provide a night patrol, at least to move all over the area. We as residents of Ye, we are tired of war. We are tired of hearing gunshot at night. You're sleeping, turning like this, you hear a gunshot. We need a really protection. The government has to provide a good security to the residents of Ye River State.
The South Sudan Army's deputy spokesman, Brigadier General Santo Domech, confirms the gunshots in Ye town. Domech says the military command in Ye has been instructed to investigate and discipline soldiers firing their weapons at night.
We have already received a report that there were some shooting in air by some individuals from the SSPDF. Whatsoever, it is just a behavior that has been done under the influence of alcohol by some individuals that represent only themselves and try to shoot on air. He or she is going to be apprehended and arrested, and then drastic measures are going to be taken against him or her. So what is happening in Ye, it is actually within the jurisdiction of the command of Ye Barak, and the commander in Ye is going to take measures to discipline those soldiers and try to stop such behavior.
Another Ye town resident who prefers to bed and fight only as Michael for safety reasons says the security situation is deteriorating.
We are not happy when we heard gunshot at night. As we are observing the peace, we are in the process of implementation of the revitalized peace agreement. We as the citizens, we are concerned that the organized forces, those who are not on duty, should not be allowed to carry guns because they are the one encouraging the shooting at night.
Roy Saeko, a resident of Loparate area in Ye, says the soldiers firing their guns at night are drunk. She blames local officials for failing to enact laws that regulate the consumption of locally brewed alcohol.
It has now turned us to now call this gunshot as being the ringtone of Ye River State. The government should really set a polish on those who are really brewing alcohol. Soldiers are really not supposed to drink alcohol to that extent of becoming totally drunk and losing their mind. Because the soldiers are drunk, they may intend to do anything that cannot really help the community.
Speaking in Arabic, Victor Lopai, a community leader in Ye town, is urging government officials to promote community policing to curtail occurrences of crimes in the community.
Community policing is very important because it is very effective in other towns. If there is any criminal problem, like gunshots, it becomes easy for the community to coordinate with the security agents. We also want to see that the government should introduce mobile phone communication mode like what happened in Wau and other parts of the country.
Ye town mayor Al-Fati Morgan called on residents not to panic. Speaking in Arabic, Al-Fati confirms it is drunken soldiers who are firing their weapons at night. He says security agencies have arrested at least two suspects who will face criminal charges in court.
I want to assure our civilians that there is nothing wrong. We are working hard to ensure that soldiers in uniform are not allowed to move with guns in the markets and bars. If found, they will be arrested, whether they belong to the army, the police, wildlife, fire brigade, or prison service, because we don't want civilians to be threatened under gunpoint in the town.
Ye River State Police Commissioner Yowasalo John Kamba says many civilians have filed complaints regarding the nighttime gunfire, but the police cannot track down the soldiers because they don't have vehicles to conduct nighttime patrols.
We are actually urging the state government or authority to avail another Land Cruiser so that it can be given to our joint team operation to track down or to silence the nine gunshots.
Lojang insists that despite the nighttime gunfire from soldiers, the security situation in Ye town remains calm. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Ye town.
The United States has urged African governments to improve their business environments to better attract major American investors. The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Thibault Nagy, made the comments during a Four Nations tour of Africa, as Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
The U.S. diplomat says many American businesses want to invest in Africa, but Thibault Nagy says they first need to see a more positive investment environment.
Which means minimum levels of corruption, fair treatment, honoring contracts, and quite frankly, a good governance environment, because that's what American businesses want.
Naj made the comments after meeting Friday with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni on the first leg of his four-nation African tour. In December, the U.S. announced its long-awaited Africa policy. The economic focus is on countering China's fast-growing influence on the continent through investment. Critics have accused China of saddling African nations with huge debts that Beijing can use as leverage, so-called debt diplomacy. While China rejects the charge, many African nations point out they have few options for funding large-scale infrastructure projects. And unlike U.S. investments, China's don't come with human rights and good governance requirements. The U.S. says its investment priority for Africa is not just to improve opportunities for U.S. business, but to also safeguard African states' independence. But Ugandan political analyst Bernard Sabiti says in responding to China, the U.S. policy on Africa is becoming more flexible.
The prerogative that the United States has always had to say, if you do not have these governance and human rights benchmarks, then you will not qualify for World Bank loans or our money. I don't think that threat is as effective as it used to be. The countries have learned that you can actually still be pretty brutal, and the United States does not necessarily back away completely.
But Sabiti says African nations still need to do better in addressing good governance, human rights and corruption to attract more and bigger U.S. investments. Assistant Secretary Naj said conflict in Africa is also hindering investment. On Monday, Naj finished a visit to Rwanda, where a diplomatic spat has soured relations with neighboring Uganda. Naj said President Museveni and Rwanda's President Paul Kagame needed to work to resolve the matter.
Both of these countries are very positive forces for the regional environment. Regional security is important for both countries. Both countries obviously have also experienced turbulence with the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo region. So we encourage our friends to discuss any disputes that they have between themselves.
Naj is scheduled on Wednesday to be in the Democratic Republic of Congo to meet with civil society and the controversially elected new government. He plans to discuss strengthening regional stability, good governance and commercial ties, as well as responding to the Ebola outbreak in the country's east. Naj's last stop is next week in Cameroon, where, among others, he will meet with members of the Young African Leadership Initiative. YALI is the U.S. government's signature effort to invest in the next generation of African leaders. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Parapa by Honey Frank.
Oh, sometimes you don't know how I'm feeling. I know you don't know how I'm acting.
You cannot feel like
oh, kukuyati ilo ade kulera ni tailai. Oh, kukuyati ilo ade kulera ni tailai. Oh, kunengolo joe adi tange. Kunengolo sopa adi rune konye.
Namaste,
oh,
caramindo, usina kubera nase.
Oh, caramindo.
We have been listening to Honey Frank with that song, Parapa. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
medeta culo mokilo por arabe bambe oh makajora mukonzi mutulu jora kituma kubonaga don't easy muses for you to keep